cliffcentral.com. Dave Rubin is a political commentator, a comedian, TV talk show host. He is a personality. All of America knows who he is. He was formerly with Aura TV and Young Turks Network, but he has happily gone solo with The Rubin Report, which is why I wanted to talk to him today on cliffcentral.com. First of all, Dave, congratulations on the move. I know it's a couple of months already since it happened, but I started talking to you just before you made the move. And having done it myself, I know how difficult it must have seemed at the time. These things are never easy to do, right?
Yeah. Well, first off, Gareth, I'm happy to finally be talking to you. We've been trying to plot this out for possibly a half a year already, and we were finally able to coordinate, which probably is a sign of, you know, two people that are owning and controlling and operating and hosting and all of that stuff related to their own thing, and just the amount of work that it actually is. You know, it sometimes seems, I think, on the outside, like, oh, you just get up there, you do some interviews that you do or that I do, or you talk to the camera or you share your thoughts, and it kind of seems like, you know, maybe not that much is involved. But as you know, it's a 28-hour-a-day job. I mean, I don't have a freaking minute during the day. I wish I did. I want to start playing video games again, but it's a long-lost art for me.
That's quite a lot I want to cover, because you've already, and I mean, you're not an old man, so you've already done a huge amount. I mean, it's it's quite incredible, the people you've spoken to. I've heard your conversations with people like Larry King and with Sam Harris and with some of the famous comedians in America. And it really is incredible to hear how much varied diversity of thought there is in the circle of American comedians, intellectuals, public thought leaders, those kinds of people. I think that's probably the strength of America, if you ask me, or the strength of any good democracy, is that there's that diversity of thought. Would you agree?
Well, absolutely. I mean, diversity of thought is the most important type of diversity there is. You know, as you know, a lot of my feelings on the left, which at one time was progressive and now I would argue is regressive, is going backwards. They love diversity in that they want to look at you and look at your immutable traits, whether you're black or Latino or white or gay or trans or whatever else. And they want diversity of visual diversity. And what matters is diversity of thought. It matters what you think about. Why do you think the government's role should be X or Y? Why do you think that we should have public funding of this or focus more on science or care more about free speech or any of these things? That's what's actually important. And, you know, America, it's funny because it's unfortunate that, you know, we've lost a little bit of our pride, a little bit of our mojo here, where people it's like if you say anything good about America these days, people think you're some weirdo, and somehow they make it seem like being a socialist or a communist is cool. And that's crazy.
Yeah.
Our experiment here, this experiment that we've had of creating a melting pot where people from all over the world, every ethnicity, every color and religion and background has come here and been part of this melting pot, meaning they brought their own traditions and then became part of the bigger American idea of freedom and liberty. It's such an absolutely beautiful thing. And of course, some other countries have done things like this. You know, Australia has done something like this, and Canada has done something like this, and a few other countries. But we've done it in a really, really special way in America. And I'm afraid we're starting to lose that because we're not paying attention to what's actually good here. And what the goodness is the richness of our diversity.
You know, you mentioned diversity, and you come from New York, which is one of the places in the world I love the most. And in New York, in Queens in particular, they say 80 different languages being spoken at any given time, which is absolutely incredible. And I imagine that kind of diversity isn't forced. It isn't the sort of thing that's cosmetically pretty to the left. It's something that happens in neighborhoods where people come for better opportunities. And I think that the thing that classical liberals, and I would venture to say that I'm in that category. You've said many times that's what you are. I would say that classical liberals probably believe in an equality of opportunity, but not necessarily an equality of outcome, which would mean that you had to do some social engineering in between. Would you agree?
Of course, of course. And that's the most important thing that a society can offer, that you have the opportunity to succeed. We can't guarantee success. Some people are smarter than other people. Some people work harder than other people. Some people are more clever. Some people can figure a way to think outside the box, et cetera, et cetera. I was actually born in Brooklyn, and I grew up in Long Island. I went to college in upstate New York. I lived in Manhattan most of my life. So I'm a true New Yorker. I happen to live in LA right now, but as we're doing this interview this moment, I'm at my sister's apartment on the Upper West Side, and I'm staring out the window here facing uptown, so basically facing Harlem. Mm-hmm. And when you really take it in, when you look at the amount of buildings that I can see, windows and air conditioners popping out of those windows, the thousands, the hundreds of thousands of people that are in my view right now that live in these buildings, it's incredible. And if you walk around New York City, you will see every single type of person, and we exist, we coexist. And that's so incredible. And it's like, people really need to understand why that's incredible. It doesn't mean that we're all going to live the exact same life, that we're all going to think the exact same thing. Of course not. That would be a terrible dystopian place to live in. But what it means is that we come here and we share in something, and all you get is the opportunity. And if it was so bad, by the way, a lot of people would be leaving. But you know what? Everyone still wants to get in. And for all these people that want us to have open borders, it's like, wait a minute, you want open borders, and then at the same time you'll tell us what a white racist patriarchy we live in. So it's all nuts.
Well, has it got better or worse under President Trump?
Well, it depends what you mean by it, I suppose. You know, at the moment, a lot of the Russia stuff, which is unfolding at the moment, I think it's being blown out of proportion by the media. I think that there's basically there is a coordinated assault by the Democrats and a certain amount of people in the media they want him impeached, period. And that's the goal. And they're going to go after everybody he's appointed and nominated and things like that. And I think that's the goal, that the goal is we're not going to play ball at all. And by the way, the Republicans, when Obama was president, didn't play ball very well either. They tried to stop him on everything, and they didn't want to negotiate. And Obama admittedly was not a great negotiator the way Bill Clinton was, you know, get behind closed doors and really make some make some agreements.
Bill Clinton was good at everything behind closed doors.
Yeah. You close a door, Bill Clinton was on his A game. Exactly. But, you know, at the moment, I don't see that much to complain about Trump. Yeah, look, maybe DeVos was the wrong person to put it, education or a few other things, but nothing has really changed yet. So I think more important is that we've got to calm people down about this.
Dave, come on. You're starting to sound like a Trump supporter. And worse than that, you're not taking into consideration how angry Hollywood has been. I mean, look at Meryl Streep at the Golden Globes. Look at that women's march the day after his inauguration. What, are you not paying attention? Are you like Kellyanne Conway?
That's funny. You know, it's so funny, this women's march, which, by the way, was organized by this woman, Linda Sarsour, who's a proponent of Sharia law. And they've got these women out there putting on hijabs, pretending that that's what women's equality is about. You've got a whole bunch of women dressing up in vaginas. They don't even know what they're protesting. But the beauty is they're allowed to do it. That shows you what a great country we have. And for the record, you know, it's funny. People say I'm being too nice to Trump. I did videos on, I think I had a video titled Why Not to Vote for Donald Trump or How to Beat Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I had people on like Sam Harris, who I truly, possibly the person I most respect on earth, lay out an absolute case of why not to vote for Trump. At the same time, I did talk to Trump supporters like Scott Adams and Milo, of course, and a couple other people. And that's what I think my place is to have these conversations. But I think everyone needs to just step back from the constant hysteria, and Hollywood is just, I live in LA, but I mean, these people are losing freaking minds.
Look, you seem to me to be someone who's tried your best to be objective. You've tried to interview people from all sides. You've tried to steer clear of putting your own opinions first. You know, you want to hear what other people have to say, which is what any good interviewer does. And I somehow think for some people, it's not enough. They want to be able to put you into a box. They want to put you in a box for your Jewishness or the secular Jewishness in your case. They want to put you in a box for your gayness. They want to put you in a box for your political evaluation of Donald Trump or any other such thing. They want to put you in a box for your thoughts on free speech. Do you find all of that as annoying as I do?
Well, look, there's a certain amount of people that just want to label you something. They want to try to find something that they think is within you somewhere, and that can somehow discredit everything you do. You know, it's funny. When I interview someone, my goal is not to debate them. I'm interviewing them. I think you know a little something about this. What you're trying to do is you're laying out some questions here so that you can figure out how I think. Now, if I was to say something that you strongly disagreed with, you might follow up in a certain way, but I suspect you would not yell at me or berate me or whatever. And that to me is what a good interview is. And I think I was always sort of that way. I learned a little bit about interaction from years of stand-up, but I think I learned a little something from Larry King and things like that. But to your real point there, I mean, look, we live in a time where everyone is online, everyone's on Twitter, everyone's screaming about everything. And a certain amount of people, no matter what I do, I could do 100 shows in a row that they love. And if I interview one guy that they don't like and I ask one question the wrong way, now they'll edit that, they'll put it on Twitter and tell everyone how awful I am. So at the end of the day, and I think this goes for anyone that's trying to create something, you just have to do what you think is right. If I was to look at Twitter every morning and go, boy, I should start adjusting my feelings because a bunch of crazy people are yelling at me, I mean, that's not a life I would want to live, and it's not a sane way to be a human.
Well, a lot of people are on there just for what I think you and some others have coined as virtue signaling, which is a term I love. Do you mind explaining that as beautifully as you explained regressive left in one of the videos I saw?
Yeah, well, virtue signaling is this constant state of outrage for everybody else. So it's generally done by these leftist white people who constantly are defending black people, defending Muslims, defending trans people, all these things. But what they don't realize is they're not really defending anything. What they're doing is they're trying to shout the loudest so that they get points. They want social points. They are virtue signaling. They are pretending to be so virtuous. But what are they actually doing? They'll scream and rant and rave about immigration. And what are they actually doing? Are they donating money? Are they volunteering time? Are they letting immigrants live in their house? Are they judging these people as collectives or individuals? Individuals is how you should judge people, not as a collective. But they're constantly judging as the collective. This is now what the left has become. Now, it's funny, I say that the left as if I'm judging them as a collective, but I now have broken down, I think, to the point where liberalism and people that believe in true liberalism, which is about individual liberty, by the way, has virtually nothing to do with modern leftism. So virtue signaling, it's just a way of doing actually nothing, but pretending you're this great person so that a zillion people will click like on your Instagram account. And in reality, you're doing nothing. And in certain ways, you're actually setting people backwards, actually.
Yeah, you're not getting into the meat of the argument. Now, you have interviewed him a couple of times. I had some conversations with him before he was barred from Twitter. But Milo Yiannopoulos has got into some pretty heavy trouble. And I think he's probably in a bad place right now. Do you think he's been targeted? Or do you think this is ultimately what happens if you are an attention seeker, as some people on the opposing side have said?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I actually was off the grid for the 10 days. I got off my phone. I didn't do videos. Well, we had scheduled some videos.
Yeah, you do this. I've heard you. You spoke to Joe Rogan about this. You do like a digital detox.
I'm trying to do it a couple times a year. I did it for 3 different weeks last year. One time in May. Then I did it Christmas week. And I just did it a couple weeks ago. I find it incredibly important. You know, I did a video just a few days ago about how it seems to me that our technology is evolving faster than our brains are. And we're all constantly staring into these screens. We're constantly clicking things. Our attention is frayed. We're not present anymore. And I don't know that this is how human brains are supposed to evolve. So I find it very therapeutic. You know, I find that I'm more present and available and actually sort of happier, and my thoughts are a little cleaner and all that when I do take these breaks. But then again, you know, I do love doing what I'm doing, what we're doing right now. And when I'm on, I'm on. So as for Milo, I happened to have been off the grid when the whole thing happened. So I didn't even know about it till about a week later. And, you know, it's funny, when you get back on the grid, the world doesn't stop without you. And there was so much new news, and then I had to catch up on that. So in answer to your question, I think he was partly destroyed by the same outrage machine that he's been part of. But, you know, I watched his press conference, and it was actually amazing. I mean, he talks about that he was the victim of child abuse, and that he doesn't play the victim in adulthood. And in a weird way, that's doubly offensive to these virtue signalers, because they want someone that should be a victim to be a victim, because they hold victimhood as virtue. And by him saying, this is something that happened to me, and I don't want your pity. This is my life now, and I own it, and I've taken control of it, and things like that. That's doubly outrageous to him. So I suspect he'll be back. I don't know if there were other things going on behind the scene or anything like that. And we'll see what happens with his book and all that. And look, as I've said to Milo on my show many times, I disagree with him on plenty of things. But I'm happy to have that conversation. And we live in a time, unfortunately, where if you talk to anyone that people don't want you to talk to, they want to tar and feather you too. And I just won't be, I'm not going to be held hostage by that.
Now, what about the mainstream media? I mean, you've been part of it, you could say, when you were on the Young Turks. You know, Aura TV is hardly the mainstream media, but you watch a lot of cable news, you watch a lot of network news. What do you think? Do you think the media, because Donald Trump is certainly taking aim at them and giving some of their own back, do you think they deserve that? Do you think that the media has let the people of the United States down and further in the world, because it's happening here too?
Yeah, I think the mainstream media has done itself a major, major disservice. For these last 8 years, they sucked up to power relentlessly. Nobody asked Obama a difficult question. I can't say nobody, but the vast majority, when I say this, I'm talking about 90% of what's thought of as the mainstream media. They didn't ask the hard questions. They went to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and they all took pictures with all the people in power, and they go to their, they call it their little nerd prom, and they all hang out together, and they go to the same parties. And if you looked at the amount of people who were in the administration who were married to news anchors or executives at the places, all of these things, it doesn't, in and of itself, each individual case doesn't mean anything. But when you add that to the tapestry of what's going on, yeah, the media has just failed miserably. And now, because the media mostly is left people, that's fairly obvious, now they're in utter hysteric mode. So now they want to be outraged over everything, and because they're trying to get their mojo back, because they don't like talking.
And they also want ratings, and they've realized that online, the best way to get ratings is to be part of the outrage machine.
Of course, and the huge problem with this is that it's like the boy who cried wolf. So if you're going to be outraged that Trump eats his steak well done with ketchup, and you're going to be outraged that Kellyanne Conway put her her feet on the couch, well, then when there's legitimate outrage, nobody cares.
Well, this is why I was so annoyed with those protests the day after his inauguration. I thought, you know what, if you're protesting on the day of his inauguration, virtually the day after, then what are you saving for when he really does something like take away one of your rights? What are you going to do then?
Of course. And even more dangerous than that, if you're protesting the day of his election, or the day of his inauguration, you're actually protesting the results of democracy. So what you're saying is democracy didn't work out the way I wanted it to. Now, we can have an interesting discussion about gerrymandering and districting and the Electoral College and things of that nature. But what you're saying is we just had 2 years of an election. Mm-hmm. The powers that be, everyone with the money, the media, all the well-connected people in D.C. and all that, all wanted one thing to happen, Hillary win, and the other thing happened. And what you're saying is, I'm a petulant child who will only accept democracy when it happens to work out for me. This is incredibly dangerous. And that's why I think what the Democrats are doing right now is so dangerous. They're making it clear. Maxine Waters, who's a Democratic congresswoman here, has said she's trying to figure out. I saw her on MSNBC trying to figure out how to impeach him. She didn't know yet. She had some papers there with some ideas.
I mean, Dave, this is what drove me mad when Ken Starr was trying to do the same to Bill Clinton. I thought, you know, this is unrelated nonsense. It's like these guys, they're on a witch hunt because they're playing the man instead of the ball.
You're 100% right. And again, this is nothing I've said actually. It could sound as if it's a defense of Republicans, but in no way is it. The Republicans, by the way, they have the House right now. Why don't they start passing some laws to get them to the president's desk so he has to do things not by executive action, but by the way that we're supposed to be governed? I mean, that's what Republicans should be doing. Instead, they're a bunch of cowards, and they're just sitting there letting him sign these executive actions, which, by the way, can be reversed by the next president the same way that that he's reversing a lot of what Obama did. So, yes, of course, when they did that whole thing and Ken Starr and all of these hypocrites like Newt Gingrich, who was having an affair at the time, and all of these other people. Our system is broken. And yet, as broken as it is, I think it's still an incredibly good system and something that can be fixed. But it can't be fixed if your whole goal is to take it down. And I think, unfortunately, the Democrats, what they should be focusing on is focus on the midterm elections, focus on running a great candidate in 2020, not focusing on just constantly trying to undermine the very principles of democracy that we have to believe in.
You know, it's such a good thing you're not into identity politics, because you would not make it for very long if you were. The gay community don't like you, because even though you are married to a man, and you're a big defender of civil liberties and the respective, you know, kind of gay rights, right to get married, right to have the same, you know, the same kind of legal relationships as anyone else would within a marriage. You say, for example, that we shouldn't worry about places that won't make a wedding cake for a gay couple, or a venue that is that prefers not to have gay people getting married there. Doesn't this put the left up against you even more in that respect?
Well, first, I think, you know, it's funny. I don't think that the gay community doesn't like me. I think I actually get a tremendous amount of support from the gay community. I'm basically just secretly saying what many of them, I'm saying publicly what many of them are secretly saying. Because look, at the end of the day, I veer a little more libertarian in this regard, in that when it comes to the cake, and by the way, we live here in a Christian nation in America, you know, it's a Judeo-Christian nation, and it is incredibly tolerant of everybody. It really is. Not to say we don't have our problems, but it truly is for religious minorities and for gay people and all of those other things. Hmm. Now, what happens? They find one baker in Indiana who doesn't want to bake a cake for a gay wedding, and it becomes national news. And then what does the left say? The left says, well, now we can – what a great excuse for more state control, for more state power to come in and say to this private businessman, you have to do this. Now, let's just change this for a second. Let's pretend that a Muslim baker refused to bake a gay wedding cake in, you know, in Detroit, where there's a lot of Muslim people. Do you think that the left would have been all attacking them? Of course not. So this goes to a certain anti-Christian bigotry, actually. But even beyond that, my bigger issue would be that, look, it would be a damn shame if that's the only baker in town and they won't bake you a cake. That's a shame. Yeah. It really is. And it's upsetting, of course. But either buy a cake in another town or move to another town where you take your job and the goodness and richness that you bring to that community and move it somewhere else. That's called your foot vote, which is a phrase that I love that I learned from Randy Barnett, who's a constitutional law professor who was on my show. If you don't like, that's the beauty of states' rights. If you don't like the way they're taxing you in New York, move to Florida, as a lot of people do. The more local control we have over things, the more control you have over your life if you don't like how you're being governed. And you know what? I know people will say, well, wait a minute. What if you don't have the finances to move and you love your community, but you just can't get a cake? Well, then you got to get a cake online. I mean, we live in 2017. You can get a cake one way or another. And just because this person may be bigoted or may not like gay people or whatever it is, we shouldn't use that as an excuse for the state to start telling private businesses what to do. So I understand that can be an upsetting feeling to people, and I appreciate that. But when we're giving over our power to the state, we should be very smart as to why we're doing it.
Well, you bring up Islam, and I think this is an interesting area of real hypocrisy for the left, because it's considered just a cute curiosity of diversity that there are things like Sharia law or hijabs, or that women might, you know, have undergone some kind of ritual back in Somalia and then run away to the United States like Ayaan Hirsi Ali. But that's to the left, of course. To people who are genuinely concerned with human rights, I think they see that there are some elements and aspects of Islam that are just not compatible with modern Western democracies. And I remember a situation on Bill Maher's show a while ago when Ben Affleck got all preachy about how Sam Harris was being a racist. And I remember you referred to this too in one of your podcasts. Do you think that Ben comes from a good place? Do you think that most people who profess to be on the left or talk like they're people on the left, do you think they really mean well? Because they care about the victim. They want to be tolerant of everybody. These are genuinely good things. But somehow they get lost in the principle and the hypocrisy of it all.
Well, look, this is a beautiful example of the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what's in Ben Affleck's heart. But I will tell you this, that when I discussed this with Joe Rogan on his show for about, you know, we did like a long 3-hour thing. I said that I thought Ben's intentions were good. that he's trying to somehow defend this, what he believes to be an oppressed minority. There happens to be 1.6 billion people in that minority, but he's trying to do something good there. Joe Rogan actually pushed me on that, and he said no. He said, I know these Hollywood types. He just wants the social cred. And that goes back to the virtue signaling we were talking about before. If you're the most outraged and you immediately – think about it. If you were in an argument, Gareth, you're arguing with someone and you said something racist, it would take some time for them to call you a racist. Like, you, people don't just immediately – a rational thinking person doesn't within a minute of a conversation scream you're gross and racist. But yeah. If you watch that interview, and it's fascinating – within a minute of it, Ben is huffing and puffing. He's angry, and he calls. He says that Sam Harris and Bill Maher are gross and racist. Bill Maher, who has been the standard bearer of the left and liberalism in America for the last 25 years, he has defended every minority, who fights against American imperialism, and has fought for minorities and all of these things. And Sam Harris, who's a neuroscientist, who was quoting Pew polls. I mean, so Affleck. I don't know what's in his heart, but I think the danger is you take people trying to have a very difficult conversation, as you just laid out, dealing with the ideas of Islam that often, when they're put into practice, in almost every case, are not good for minorities or gay people or people of other religions, and in most cases not even good for Muslim people themselves. That's an incredibly difficult conversation to have, but it's a real conversation, and it's one that most people know we should be having. But when your reaction to that, to two measured people who are liberals, is to call them racist, you've imploded the argument. And that's why that moment of television became so seminal for so many people, myself included, because I didn't even know who Sam Harris was before that. And I watched that, and I sort of had a political awakening around it, and I know that many other people did as well.
Now, what are your feelings on organized religion and its ability to add moral rectitude to philosophy and to our position in the world now in 2017?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I never really talked about religion that much, or atheism, or either or, until the last year and a half or so. And I never even – look, I would consider myself – This is what I always say about religion. If somebody said to me, "Oh man, Dave, I was watching the Cavs game last night and LeBron James dunked from half court," I would say, "Well, I'm going to need to see some videotape on that. I would need some evidence on that." And I would apply that same very simple, same principle to anything else. So the idea of a God that's judging us and looking down on us in heaven and hell and all of these things, I would say what Carl Sagan said, which is extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. That's all I would say about religion. If someone is religious in their own life and their private life, and it brings them peace and happiness and all of those things, which, by the way, it does for many people, I think that's great. I don't care what you believe, as long as you don't try to legislate your beliefs onto me. So it's funny, I've sort of been caught in the middle of this because I do talk about this stuff, and I've had believers and non-believers alike on my show. You know, I've had extremely prominent atheists like Sam and Lawrence Krauss and many others, Michael Shermer. And, you know, I've had plenty of people of faith like Ben Shapiro and Dennis Prager. And I just had Bishop Barron, who's from the Archdiocese here in LA, on. And they disagree on wildly huge issues, you know, hugely important issues.
Yeah, there seems to be there isn't really a church of the secularists. You find some who are very hardline anti-theists. You find some who are very, very tolerant, in fact, quite keen on the idea of spirituality, which is kind of numinous and inoffensive to most people. But it is interesting to me because... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, just to that point, you know, Sam's last book is called Waking Up, and it's a guide to spirituality without religion. So you can don't have to be religious to have a need for a spiritual side, to have a need for some inner peace or something that meditation can bring you, or a walk in the park or a hike or something of that nature. That those are important components of just a human life. And there's ways to attain those things without having to believe in dogmatic things that you can't prove.
Right. I was just going to say, though, that the irony of it all is that, you know, you're kind of born into a religion most of the time, and people just take it on because it's what their parents did.
Of course. And look, for me, as you mentioned before, I'm Jewish. To me, you know, Judaism slightly different because it's thought of as an ethnicity and a religion. Mm. Most Jews are not religious. Yes, there are ultra Orthodox Jews, but most secular Jews that anyone knows, they have an affinity for holidays, for the richness of the tradition that their parents, you know, celebrated Passover the way their grandparents did and their grandparents before them. And you can keep going back and back and back and back. That's an ethnic identity to me more than a religious identity. So I don't believe, again, in any of these things that I can't prove the religious components of it. But I fully identify with the history of my people, which, by the way, is an extremely painful one. Yep. Of people that have been, you know, pogromed and holocausted and slaughtered throughout time. It's not the most fun history there is, but I know that's the history of my people. Now, believing in something that I can't prove is a completely separate issue than an ethnic identity. And that one's a little different for Judaism than for most religions.
Yeah, it is. There's certainly a cultural component to it, which is, 5,000 or more years strong. So I don't think anyone's going to argue with you. What do you know about what we're sort of doing in South Africa, about how, what a road we've walked, the obvious racial divisions of the past? You know, there are a lot of complicated and identity political issues in South Africa, which I think you'd find quite familiar. But do you know much about it?
You know, I don't know a tremendous amount other than what occasionally comes across on Twitter from a few people I follow. But I do have family in South Africa. I have a cousin who was just in the States, who I had never met before, who I met a couple months ago. And I absolutely do want to visit there and find out more. But I don't know that I can comment in a way that would be fully I could probably fake it, but I won't do that to you.
I love that, because that, to me, again, one of the marks of intelligence. The first one to me is being curious. The other one is just saying, I don't know if you don't know, right?
Well, you know, it's funny. Everyone, and I do think this is partly because of Twitter and social media, everyone thinks that they have to be an expert in everything, which I think is not only absurd, of course, but it's hilarious. So things happen. You know, Obama, tears up the order that we can't go to Cuba. Suddenly, everyone on Twitter, people who had never tweeted about Cuba before, they're all experts on Twitter. Yeah. All these experts on the Iran nuclear deal, these people who couldn't do anything in their own lives, somehow they know every in and out of this complex nuclear deal and about nuclear fission and all of these things and yellow cake uranium. And it's like, guys, you're embarrassing yourself. So it's okay. It is okay to occasionally say, I need to learn more, I don't know that much, or I'm just going to sit this one out. It's actually okay.
Dave, thanks so much for talking to us. I know how busy you are at the moment, and I heard the familiar sirens of the Upper West Side just a moment ago. I love New York. Yeah. It's such a great place.
You know what? I can give you a bonus 4 minutes here if you got anything else.
You know what?
I got a text that something was that delayed a little bit, so I got 4 minutes.
No problem. I mean, I'm quite curious about how you you get along, if at all, with the guys from the Young Turks, because that was the first time I encountered you. And I know that the politics of that show now are very different to the politics of or even the open-mindedness of your show at the moment.
Yeah, you know, look, I was good friends with a lot of them. I don't regret my experience there. And I think that something happened generally to progressives as a group. Something happened to progressives as a group right around that Bill Maher episode with Sam and Ben Affleck. And I saw progressives go off the deep end. And then it was a couple other things, because then there was Charlie Hebdo and a few other things where progressives suddenly weren't defending free speech. And they were suddenly, again, putting Islam at the height of this oppression Olympics. Mm. The most regressive ideology was becoming their most important thing as progressives. So as far as my personal relationships, yeah, I mean, look, I've publicly challenged Cenk many times and he refuses to respond because he knows that I would destroy him. Not even that's my modus operandi or what I like to do. But at first when I did it, it was fully done in respect. You can look at all the tweets I've ever sent him. And the first 10 or 15 public times that I reached out to him, the one was a tweet storm of about 10 tweets saying, you know, this is what I think's going on here and blah, blah, blah. And then eventually it just turned because he just kept lying. And no matter how much evidence you show him of you're misquoting people, you're lying about this, all that, he just doubles down even more. So he's destroyed his own brand and his own thing. And that's perfectly in his purview to do. As for the rest of them, yeah, unfortunately, I had some good friends there that won't talk to me anymore.
Wow.
But I've met better friends, quite honestly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not a believer. I'm not a believer in losing friends over politics. I make a point of it. I had a massive political debate with an old friend the other day, and we were disagreeing on a lot of stuff. And I paused him in the middle, and I said, you know, Bob, whatever we talk about here, no matter how heated we get, our friendship supersedes this stuff. And we both sort of took a breath and had a drink, and we were fine after. And that's incredibly important. But the people who are not doing it, and I'm not making this up or being hyperbolic when I say this, this is almost exclusively on the left, because I get emails about it every day of people saying, my friends drop me, my brother won't talk to me. I posted a clip of your show. It's the most centrist modern thing there is. And you know, they're calling me a right-wing crazy person or all this. And this is an intolerance of the left. And it simply doesn't happen on the right in any large scale. It just doesn't.
So do you think, with that in mind, do you think that it's an insult anymore to be called center-right? Because it used to be the right used to, that used to be the place that we had to be wary of. That was where the book burners came from. That was where the neo-Nazis and the fascists would eventually pretend to be more moderate and live in that neighborhood. You know, now, obviously, these are the people who seem almost sensible.
Yeah. Well, look, the power of it is disappearing, and that's a beautiful thing. These words are becoming meaningless. They've cried out to the point of calling everyone Hitler. They think Trump is Hitler. And then they'll yell at everyone's a white supremacist and everyone's a homophobe and a bigot and all of these buzzwords that everyone knows don't have any meaning anymore. That I think the next step is that for the rest of us to be woke, so to speak, as you know, the kids like saying online, is that we have to just, if you're not a racist, if you're not a bigot, if you're not a woman hater or a gay hater or anything else, be confident in what you think. Speak clearly about what you believe. And at the end of the day, right now, as it stands, it's easier for me to build bridges with people on the right. So people like Glenn Beck, who's basically a libertarian who I had on my show, or Ben Shapiro or Dennis Prager, guys who I disagree with certainly about religious philosophical things, and I disagree with many of them on a lot of things related to gay marriage or to abortion or even death penalty. I disagree with Prager on all three of those. But I find it much easier to sit down with him and say, okay, let's find where the agreement is, because we're both basing our positions on individual liberty. And if you put individual liberty, the right to live your life as you see fit, if you put that ahead of everything else, that's how you build a stable society, because that's what humans want. So I don't want to tell you how to live, and I hope you don't want to tell me how to live. Now, we got to figure out a way for us all to coexist within that, and that's what the job of government should be. And some of us want it bigger, and some of us want it smaller. But the point is, it's your life, and it's up to you what to do with it, not for me to tell you how to live it.
I love it. I don't think we could end this on a better note. Thank you so much for your time. All the best with the Rubin Report going forward. I'm delighted to see you flourishing, and I hope that we'll be able to talk again soon. CliffCentral.com.